Good, thanks. On this edition of Conversations, the path to mental health. We assume mental health is related to how we feel. Strong self-esteem, resolved issues, a positive outlook. But is it? Over the next hour, we'll take a look at the insides and the outsides of mental health from perspectives that originated in Japan and are taking a Western shape in this country. Greg Kretsch is our guest. His expertise, Nikon and Morita therapies, and what's known as constructive living. Constructive living has taken Nikon and Morita and blended them to bring them to the West. We'll learn more about each of these subjects in this hour of Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Susan. It's nice to be here.
Good. Welcome. Let's start with notions of mental health. Can you characterize Western mental health, ideas about Western mental health for us, so we can move from there?
Well, actually, I want to make clear that I'm actually not trained in Western mental health. But I think that there are some assumptions, as I've worked, because a lot of the work I do is, in fact, now training Western mental health professionals in alternative approaches, including these that come from Japan and constructive living. And I think we make some assumptions that really need to be tested or looked at. For example, one of those assumptions seems to be that our feelings control our behavior. So I'm depressed, and therefore I lie around on the couch for an hour. Or I'm feeling really anxious about my job interview tomorrow, so I don't show up for it. And I know for many years I had this view that the reason I did things was based on how I felt. Mm-hmm. I yelled because I was angry, for example. And when I did my own training and really tried to look at that assumption, I found that it's just not true, that in fact there are lots of times when I feel angry and I don't yell. And I have this experience, and maybe some of your listeners can identify with this, when it's in the morning and I'm the first moment that I'm aware that I'm awake. And what feelings do I have? And I have feelings like sleepiness and drowsiness and heaviness. And then these thoughts are popping into my head like, oh, I'll just hit the snooze alarm and go back to sleep for 10 minutes. Or, God, I didn't sleep well last night. I'll never be able to get through today. Mm-hmm. And having those feelings and having those thoughts, one foot goes over the side of the bed and the other foot goes over the side of the bed. And I start walking towards the bathroom and putting cold water on my face. So it's not that my feelings control my behavior, or I'd have to lay in bed until I was motivated and enthusiastic about getting up, which I never do, really. So I began to see that, in fact, our feelings are our feelings, but our behavior is not the same thing. In fact, we can control our behavior, even though we may not be feeling like doing a particular thing.
Okay. Greg Kretsch is with us today on Conversations. Any idea how mental health has become feelings associated in the West?
I'm not sure how that evolved. It seems like many years ago, a lot of our views about mental health were views about just living your life well and kind of common sense wisdom. And it seems like more and more we've gone inside ourselves trying to explore our psyche and understand why we do what we do and get in touch with our feelings. And if that worked, then I think it would make sense. But my experience in working with people and in what I see is that it doesn't seem to work very well, and that in many cases what happens is that as our attention shifts to trying to understand ourselves and figure ourselves out, we're not taking care of kind of these very ordinary daily things we need to do in our life. And I remember for years I would go to workshops and training programs thinking that, you know, I needed to find the secret to getting my life together. And it would be fascinating. The people would talk about all kinds of interesting intellectual ideas about your subconscious and the past and myths. And I remember one day vividly coming home after this very interesting intellectual workshop, and the electricity company had turned my electricity off because I hadn't paid my bill, because my bills were stuck in piles that were just completely disorganized all over my office. And I thought, isn't there something in mental health that has to do with having your bills organized and paying them on time and getting things done when they're supposed to be done? And I picked up a book by David Reynolds called Playing Ball on Running Water, and it was something that, on the one hand, originated in Japan, and on the other hand, had this very practical application towards getting your dishes washed and paying your bills and really kind of taking care of your life. And here was this idea that was so new to me about mental health having to do with living your life well. not necessarily always feeling happy or joyful or serene, but really figuring out how you want to live your life, what you want to do, what you want to accomplish, and doing those things.
How, and this is our, I think, our hour's discussion, or at least part of our hour's discussion, so it only needs probably a preliminary answer, but how, where do the emotions fit? You're pointing towards a mental health that is more external, more physical reality oriented, and less emotional, attitudinal, less have feelings oriented. Mm-hmm. Where do the feelings fit? What do I do with those?
Well,
in this consideration, because I still perhaps was sexually abused as a child, a battered, had a traumatic experience, may have a terminal disease, about all of which I have feelings.
The psychiatrist Morita suggested that our feelings, in fact, are basically uncontrollable, that we really can't control them. And so, for example, he would suggest, and I would agree, that your listeners can't really control whether they like or enjoy the show or not. They can listen to it, and they'll have a response to it. And they may feel like this was really interesting, or they may feel like they thought this guest was really terrible today. But they really can't control that. And I think most of us, if we check out our experience, we can't control whether we fall in love with someone, or if we've just ended a relationship, whether we fall out of love with somebody. We can't control whether we feel depressed. If we could, we would just immediately get rid of our depression. And what Morita suggested was, if you can't control your feelings, if you can't control something, in fact, the best thing to do is to accept it. And I think we're generally taught one of two options, to either suppress or deny those feelings, or that we have to always express them and talk about them. And here's this option of being able to accept or coexist with my depression at this particular moment, or coexist with my anxiety. And one of the nice ways I like to look at it is, if you imagine a play, and for many people, the director of that play is their feelings. So there's all these other actors, but everybody always has to follow what the feelings say. You know, I feel, for years, the question I would ask myself in any situation was, do I feel like doing this? And whatever the answer was, I either did or didn't do it. And what I see is making a shift in that structure of administration of the play, so that the director of our life is instead our purpose or what we want to do. And our feelings have a role in that play, but they're not running the show. So sometimes they're on stage, sometimes they have an important part. When I was thinking about getting married, how I felt about the woman I was involved with, my fiancée, was a very important part of that. But there was also other practical questions, like, is she already married? And what are our mutual goals? And where would we live? And what about kids? And there were these other elements of reality that also, you know, had to play a part in that. So I think the idea of allowing our feelings to kind of be there, and sometimes our feelings give us really useful information. Sometimes I was on the subway in New York, and it was late at night, and I looked up, and I realized there's no one else in the subway car but me. And that particular feeling, I think, was giving me really good information, which was, move to the next car where there are other people. But sometimes I have feelings, and I don't think they're giving me any particularly good information. I'm afraid or anxious about something, and there's really nothing different I need to do. And so to just be able to accept that feeling, but then shift my attention back to what is it that I need to do now.
When those feelings come up for you, not necessarily, well, all of them, I suppose, anxiety on the subway as well as anxiety prior to going to speak to a group or walking into a new place, do you mentally stop as you're walking towards and say, what is this, Greg? What are you feeling?
No, mostly I don't.
You don't? You don't identify it and...
No,
move through it.
And I think sometimes there's assumption that that when we have a feeling, we need to kind of give it a certain amount of time or work through it or process it. And my experience is life just isn't like that. You know, I mean, sometimes life gives us that opportunity. But a lot of times things happen in our life and we have to act on the situation very quickly. We suddenly we're in an accident and our child is bleeding. And we don't sit there and think, I'm really afraid of this and I really need to now express these feelings and talk about them and get in touch with them. We see what happens and we have to act, because that's what needs to be done in that situation. And I think In many cases, those feelings take care of themselves. Once we get our child to the hospital, they see a doctor and they're okay, there's nothing that needs to really be done about those feelings. But again, I think in Western mental health, we've moved more in this direction of raising or elevating feelings up to make them more important than the rest of our life. And I'm arguing more for acknowledging them and accepting them, but also accepting and acknowledging other important things in our life, including, for instance, our responsibilities and things that we need to do.
You were talking about the director of life's play. It's I'm feeling from what you're saying to me that the kind of approach you're using puts the being, the human, Susan or Greg or whomever else is listening, more into the driver's seat. You think so?
I think that when we try to control things that aren't controllable, whether it's our depression or whether it's other people's behavior, you know, we don't like what this person did, and we're going to try to change their behavior. Let's say they're an alcoholic. And most of us who have tried to change other people's behavior, particularly if you have kids or if you have parents, realize you can't control someone else's behavior. But when we try to do that, whether it's with our feelings or someone else's behavior, we're left often with a sense of disempowerment and frustration and anger, and it's a very unpleasant experience. But when we really shift our efforts to what we can control, which is how we're living our life, our own behavior, then we are much more in control, in the sense that I can control coming on your show even if I feel anxious. Mm-hmm. I can control getting my dishes washed even if I don't feel enthusiastic about that. And as my life kind of gets more on track, in the sense that here I am, there's these things I want to do in my life, and I'm not allowing my feelings to distract me or keep me from doing those things, well, your experience is very, very much different.
Okay. I want to take a look at some examples, so we'll do that in just a second. Greg Kretsch is with us on Conversations today. He's the executive director of the Toto Institute in Middlebury, Vermont, and has been since 1990. He edits a quarterly journal called the Constructive Living Quarterly as well. His expertise, once again, is in constructive living, which we're learning about today, also Nikon and Morita therapies, which we'll talk more about as we move along. You told a story, and I'm kind of so immersed at the moment, I can't remember whether you told it on the tape that I heard or in a quarterly article. But in any case, it's about a young woman whom I think you know, but this may be just an instructive story, whose paper was midway written,
right,
eaten by the computer, totally lost. And it's also a story about ants and about spider web.
Right.
Can you real briefly introduce that story to us, and then we talk about that in terms of mental health?
Sure. And it's actually a true story, in fact, even with even the part about the ants and the spider webs for the most part.
Good.
But it's a true story about a woman who had gone back to school, was getting her graduate degree, and had an important paper due and had been working on it all day, and suddenly it was just gone. And she had not saved it onto a floppy disk, and she had not written it out in handwriting. There was basically no notes at all. And she called me up and said, you know, that's it. I shouldn't be going back to school anyway. And so she has all of these feelings, right? She's angry. She's upset with herself. She's frustrated. She's thinking that, you know, this is it. I should just quit. This is too much for me. I shouldn't have done this. And here's this moment where she has these feelings and she has these thoughts. And then the question is, what is she going to do now? And she creates her history, really, by making that choice of what's going to be done now. And she did, in fact, because she ended up rewriting the paper. And now her history is that she got her graduate degree.
She creates her history.
That's by what she does now.
That's very nice, yes.
And then the part of the story is about a spider who's spent all day building this web. And here's this juicy fly for dinner, and then a little kid comes along in the garage and knocks the web off, and the fly's gone. And now there's no food, and there's no web, and there's no notes or architectural drawings. And here's the spider that now goes to work spinning the next web. And the same thing with the ants. Someone steps on the anthill, and their ant hill is just in rubble, and ants have died, and there's no air. And the next thing is to start rebuilding the anthill. And so there's something, again, about doing the next thing in our life. We can't really control a lot of the things that happen to us. There are circumstances, whether it's the weather or an earthquake or floods in the Midwest, that we really can't control. But we can control how we respond to those things in terms of what we do about them. And I think building our life on our actions gives us this kind of solid foundation of being able to respond moment by moment to what situations come up in our life. But our emotions are such a roller coaster, at least mine are. I mean, mm-hmm. I go from being depressed to being happy to being anxious to being tired. And if I allow my life to follow that roller coaster, then my life becomes a roller coaster. And it's a very difficult way to live, going up and down like that all the time.
And besides, you tend not to pay your bills, perhaps, or get the paper written, or go to work, or whatever that other thing is. Huh. This may seem all too obvious, but tell me how it is that sitting down to finish that paper, start that paper again and working through it, is better for her mental health. I mean, if we're looking at mental health during this hour, mm-hmm. how does that relate, even though it seems like an obvious question?
Well, let's say the paper is due in 2 days, and she can wait until the next day. And in waiting, she's probably, her attention is going to keep coming back to, why didn't I save that paper on a floppy disk? And why didn't I print it out? And I should have done that. And I really don't feel like rewriting this paper. And she may end up not doing it at all, in which case one of the things that changes is she doesn't get her degree. But even if she waits and does it at the last minute, what she's really done is, by not doing it earlier, she's created all these extra moments of suffering. Mm-hmm. Because in reality, what she did was, the paper was due the next day. She sat back down and started writing on it. By the next morning, it was done. Some parts were better than the earlier version. Some parts weren't. But as soon as she got it completed, all of her suffering, her anxiety about not having saved the paper, her worries, her thoughts about not going back to school, really just kind of took care of themselves. And one of the things that I like to point out is that it seems so much more sensible to really keep our focus on taking care of our life and allowing our feelings to take care of themselves in that sense. And I think in many ways in the West, we've gone to the other direction, which is trying to work on our feelings internally while our life gets put on hold. And sometimes we can afford to do that, but sometimes life won't wait for us. It just keeps going. And we miss lots of opportunities to do really important things.
But we also have a lot more opportunities to focus on why our life's out of control.
Absolutely. And, right? And it almost is a spiral. You know, the more we put things off, the more we're trying to, I better start really trying to understand, why am I the kind of person that puts things off? And it creates this spiral. The Japanese actually have a term for that. They call it torowaré, this kind of internal spiral of, why am I like this? And then, why am I the kind of person who's depressed? And then it's, I feel guilty about being depressed. Why am I the kind of person who's so guilty about being depressed? And the more we get caught in that spiral, the more we really experience a lot of internal suffering. And meanwhile, life is just kind of going on and passing us by, and things we need to do aren't getting done.
Start cutting some of those threads. If you're sitting across from a person who feels exactly as you have just described, who is locked in torodoro, is that right?
Torowaré.
Torowaré, mm-hmm. Sorry. Locked in torowaré. Mm-hmm. How would you approach that person? What would you say?
Well, one of the things that I want to help them do is just make that immediate shift of attention away from themselves and onto what they need to do. See, the only way to break that cycle is to break it. So the person who's so caught up in trying to figure themselves out, what I want to do is to shift their attention not towards figuring themselves out, but what is it that you need to be doing in your life? And let's start doing that. And for a lot of people, that's a real shift. And it's also a lot of hard work.
I was going to say, I'm too depressed to think about this, Greg.
Yeah. and I think... in a way, it's much easier to go in and, whether you're talking to a therapist or talking to your friend on the phone, to just talk about your problems and keep focusing on them and talk about them and not do anything about them. Mm-hmm. In a way, that's easier than the hard work of actually having to do things. But in a way, it's also harder, because you talk and talk and talk and the things don't get done and you're not changing anything in your life. That's terribly frustrating and actually much more difficult, really, than putting in the effort that it takes to actually do something or make some changes.
So help us towards developing a purpose. How is that once we know we have to get about it, mm-hmm. what does it look like?
Well, I think some people seem to have life purposes, you know, some kind of mission in life, something that's really important to them. We think of maybe someone like Albert Schweitzer. Mm. But most people that I know, and certainly a lot of my life, purpose is really a moment-to-moment thing. It's what's my purpose in being on your show today? And being clear about that. And not allowing if I feel anxious or if I feel uncomfortable or if I'm a little hoarse in my throat, not allowing that kind of experience to keep me from accomplishing my purpose. For some people, their purpose, I gave a lecture for the hospice center today. There are people who are volunteer workers for the hospice center, and their purpose is to really provide care and help to other people. So keeping their focus on that purpose. But really, I think it's helpful to see our purpose not always as this giant, big, lifelong purpose, but what's my purpose in asking the next question?
Yes.
Or what's my purpose in walking into this room? How many times have we walked into a room, gotten into the room, and thought, what did I come in here for? Right? So purpose can be very much just this moment-to-moment thing.
And involve the details of relationship and work and down to combing one's hair and up to getting a PhD or whatever up is to anyone else.
Absolutely. And I think everybody has their own purpose and has their own list of what they need to do. And so part of one of my own principles from constructive living is I really can't know what someone else needs to do. So if someone comes in and they say, I'm overweight, I need to exercise, I'll help them do that, or I need to diet, or I need to stop smoking. But that's really their life, and it's really up to them. And part of knowing that is I've made so many mistakes in my own life that I don't always know what to do in my own life, so how could I know what someone else needs to do? But I think the Morita side of constructive living, which is mostly what we've been talking about, action, self-discipline, is really a wonderful tool for when you know what needs to be done in your life, being able to take action and do it and put it into practice.
And the three tenets of the Morita side are exactly what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So first being accept your feelings. Right now I'm feeling depressed, or right now I'm a bit anxious. Don't try to fight with them. Don't try to fix them or change them. But accept your feelings, and secondly, know what your purpose is, what is it that you need to do, and thirdly, do what you need to do.
You're convinced that this can be done by any human being, whether that person has had a tragic past or has a tragic future that they're aware of, or a present that's falling mm-hmm. apart. Those three things can be done.
It may well be, I think, that there are some people who are so out of touch with reality, people who have serious mental illness, for example, that it's really very hard for them to use any approach to life. But my wife is actually the director of a mental health center for people with mental illness, and she uses this and with those folks, and a lot of them respond very positively to this because they've spent years trying to think of what their family did to them and how come they had a breakdown, and here's something that just grounds them in this very practical, what do you need to do today? If your purpose is to get back and find a job and get into the workforce, what are the steps that need to be taken? And you're going to have, people will have lots of feelings about that. They'll say, I'm scared of going back to work. I haven't worked since my breakdown 15 years ago. I have no confidence that I can do that job. And one of the things that I point out to people is that you shouldn't have confidence if you haven't done something, right? When I first went to use a computer, if some of your listeners can remember the first time maybe trying to use a computer, I had no confidence that I could use a computer. But how do you get confidence? Well, you do something over and over and over again, and then maybe you develop a little bit of confidence. So when someone says to me, I don't have any confidence I can do this, the important thing is to go ahead and do it. And in the doing will help to influence your confidence. But if we seem to have this idea that we need to create this feeling of confidence before we can actually take that step of doing it. And a lot of times that's a real formula for just never doing the thing.
This is Greg Kretsch, and you're listening to Conversations. You may be at this point wondering where to find out more information. There are books written by the founder of Constructive Living in the United States. His name is Dr. David Reynolds. He's thought of as the leading authority on Japanese psychology in the United States. A quick look at three titles. I think David has written 20 or more books in Japanese and in America.
Yes.
So among those, Constructive Living is talked about as the grandfather text. It's a very slim volume, published by the University of Hawaii Press in 1984, comes out in paperback. Playing Ball on Running Water, which Greg referred to earlier, is a William Morrow book, came out in 1984. There are several, actually, around 1984, 85, 86. Plunging Through the Clouds is the most recent. It is edited by David Reynolds. And Greg has two chapters in it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, two chapters in this book. So it's edited by David Reynolds, published by SUNY Press, that's from the State University of New York, and came out in 1993. In that book, Greg's chapters are called The Practice of Nikon and Constructive Living Guidelines for Life at Work, two of the pieces that Greg has written for inclusion in that book and many others in other places. This is Conversations. You're listening today to Greg Kretsch. One more story. You told, and I think this is on the audio tape I listened to, which incidentally people will wonder, is called Nikon Hidden Gifts Revealed and is a 90-minute cassette. Perhaps later in the hour we can tell how folks can get that if they'd like to. You told a story about obstacles and why obstacles are valuable in your life. Mm. If we've stopped and taken a look at a paper being eaten or dreadful difficulties in life and attitudes about them. Now let's look through that story at why obstacles are useful. Is that enough information for your memory to come up?
Well, yeah, it was a story about, I think, taking a hike. And,
yes.
And there was, people in Alaska may have this experience given the roughness of your winters, but taking a hike down a forest path, and it was early spring, and there was all of these trees that were down, and they were blocking the path. And I kept thinking, you know, the Forest Service needs to get out here and take a chainsaw and cut these things down. And then I came back on that path and actually started to count how many trees, in fact, had been removed, where you could see someone had taken a chainsaw and removed that section on the path because you could see the top of the tree on the right and the bottom of the tree on the left. And it turned out that many more trees had been cleared than the ones that were in my way. But I just kept paying attention to those trees that I had to go under and over and around. And I think that our life is like that it's really our attention to things that shape our experience. And so we get up in the morning and maybe we do a few things and we take a shower and there's no hot water. And so here's that obstacle or problem, right? And we go to work and we do a few more things and then the printer on our computer doesn't work. And then another thing happens. And at the end of the day, when we're ready to go to bed, we may have this idea that what a rough day, what a tough day. Boy, am I glad this is over. But it's not that it was a tough day as much as it was that's all we paid attention to was problem after problem after problem. And in between all those problems, there was hot coffee and hot water, and there was electricity for the lighting in my office, and there was a telephone that worked, and there was toothpaste and toothbrush to brush my teeth. All of those things basically were working fine. It's just that they were working so fine, I didn't pay any attention to them. And the Nikon side of this material really says, don't just look at the obstacles or problems in your life because it's not realistic. So in addition to that, you need to kind of widen your vision or broaden your vision to also take into consideration all of these things that are supporting you and caring for you and working for you. And when we start to look at that, our experience, I think, changes quite dramatically. We begin to not take things for granted so much because we're noticing them. I worked with a teacher once from Vietnam who used to give a lecture, and he'd start out by saying, I want you to all notice, for those of you who this is true for, that you don't have a toothache right now. And isn't it true? How many times do we stop and say, boy, it's really nice not to have a toothache? But when we have a toothache, boy, are we upset and in pain and angry, and we would give almost anything not to have that toothache. And isn't it true in life that we take so many things for granted, including people in our lives? And then when they're gone, or when we have a problem, then we notice it. And I think what Nikon is about is it's an approach to life that tries to get us to see the whole picture, not just those logs that are in our way, but all the things that have also been done to make our life easier and better.
Notice and be grateful. I mean, is that there too? Yes.
I think that sometimes it seems to me a natural response that when we begin to notice what people are doing for us or the things that are available that are making our lives better, that we feel grateful. But from the Morita standpoint, see, I don't think you can control whether you feel grateful. So I don't suggest that people look at these things in order to try to get themselves to be grateful. Because that would kind of be like trying to control your feelings.
Well, this is not a feeling thing, is it?
No, it's really just about being realistic. Some people say, well, isn't this positive thinking? You know, but it's not really positive thinking. It's kind of realistic thinking. It's just looking at the actual realities of my life, that my friend John drove me to the interview and you got me some water and someone gave me a couch to sit on. And my life is such that a lot is done for me. And when I'm paying attention to that, often I am feeling grateful. But sometimes I'm not. And that's okay, because I really can't control that. But it's important, I think, to just notice the bigger picture of things. And you mentioned if we can maybe shift to a more clinical example, mm-hmm. someone, let's say, who looks at their childhood and there was a lot of problems and they were mistreated or hurt, even in a serious way. And the Nikon is going to suggest to them, and this is really important, not to deny that those things happened, because they did. But there were other things that also happened that were true as well, that their diapers were changed and someone fed them and someone gave them a bed to sleep in and a room to stay in and paid for their schooling and gave them books. And Nikon is going to say, that's also part of what your childhood was like. And I think what happens is, not just in a situation for someone, for instance, who had a difficult childhood, but even in a relationship with our spouse, that when we get into an argument, it's like that thing that they did becomes the whole picture. You can't see anything else. You're just so angry. How could they have done this to me? And then, of course, once we step back from that and some time goes by, then we realize, well, that was just this incident. But I think what Nikon is going to suggest is it's better to look at life realistically. So this happened, but also these things happened as well. And we realize often that people weren't perfect. My spouse or my father or my friends or teachers, they're not perfect, and really neither am I. And that we need to accept people because people are changeable, and sometimes they do things that are really nice and kind and sometimes they don't. And that's a more accurate picture, I think, of most human beings.
Some people would say to you, but you have to appreciate the magnitude. Having my diapers changed when I was X years old is nothing compared to what happened to me in this other situation, which was by someone else's action, and I am victim of that.
And I think that that's a legitimate concern. But for example, let's say that after I leave here today, I go over to one of the nice lakes in Alaska, and I'm boating, and I fall out of the boat, and I'm drowning, and someone actually saves me and brings me back to life through mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And so what I've received from that person is they've saved my life. Now, is there anything that I can give them in return that's going to equal that, outside of maybe saving theirs? The reality is that we're born as babies without the ability to really take care of ourselves. And if someone didn't do that, we would die. That's just part of being a human infant. So someone not only gave us life, our parents, but someone, whether it was our parents or our adoptive mothers or nanny or whatever, cared for us in a way that kept us alive on a daily basis. Now, that's a pretty big magnitude also. One of the assumptions when I work with mental health professionals in the West is the question of, is it more important to thank our parents or to forgive them? And we seem to have much more of an approach of talking about how my parents messed me up, and trying to get to the point where I can forgive them for that. But again, what about this other side, which is looking at how they took care of me in these very practical, concrete ways, even when they didn't feel like it? And what about thanking them for that? So see, both things are real, and to discount one or the other is really not very realistic.
Nikon is then a meditation on the balance of things. Is that...
One of the ways to think about constructive living is the Morita side is really the action side, and the Nikon side is kind of the reflective side. And I think it's really nice to have a balance of that in our life, to be active and taking action and doing things, and to also be reflecting on how we're living, so that we do have some opportunity to look at how did I live today, what was my life like, what did I do. I think those two things work very well together, and that's why I think Morita and Nikon kind of complement one another. And Nikon requires a certain amount of quiet, reflective time, even if it's only 5 or 10 minutes at a time. And I think that's important for us to build that time into our lives. In Japan, the traditional approach to Nikon involves someone actually taking a whole week to do nothing but reflect on their lives in that way, which sounds 16 hours a day, in fact. But not looking at, interestingly enough, as we reflect on our lives, not looking at what did other people do to hurt or mistreat me, but looking at what have other people given to me and how have they supported me. And as we begin to look at that, again, our picture of our life becomes much more balanced. And we begin to see, I think, often how much has really been done for us, and that gives us some good realistic perspective on our life and the fact that I couldn't be doing what I'm doing if it wasn't for all these people who taught me this and all these books that were given to me and someone taught me to even speak these words because I wasn't born speaking English. So it's kind of an acknowledgement that that there's really this myth of the self-made person in our society.
I was just going to ask you about that. This is very important for Americans. You know, I did this on my own. Uh-huh. You know, no, I put myself through school. Yeah, well, I've been getting up early to study. I mean, we say these things almost as a cultural writ.
Yeah, absolutely. As we seem to be very preoccupied with independence, and sometimes it leads us to be unrealistic about also acknowledging how dependent we really are on other people. And I think that, again, it's not a question really of the difference between American and Japanese culture. It's really a question of just being realistic, that realistically, there are electronic mechanisms in this studio, cords and microphones and sound machines and boards. And without that, we couldn't be telecasting this radio program. And so just to be acknowledging that reality, and it's I find it's a good example because sometimes a lot of the cords and wires are hidden behind the walls, right?
Yes.
And the reality, though, is that they're still there. Even though I can't see those cords, they're allowing that signal to go from one place to another. And when we do Nikon, sometimes what happens is the things that have been done to support us and help us and care for us and contribute to our success, we begin to see those things that have been hidden for many, many years of our life.
This is Greg Kretsch. He is with us today on Conversations. Greg has been involved with constructive living with Nikon and Morita Therapy since 1987 when he began his professional training. He has studied in Japan at several centers, the Nara Nikon Center, the Senkobo Nikon Center, and the Toyama Nikon Center. He has done his constructive living and Morita training with Dr. David Reynolds in the United States and has a Morita instructor certification as well as expertise in constructive living. In Fairbanks, he's been giving classes in constructive living, one emphasizing Nikon psychotherapy, another Morita psychotherapy, also in meaningful life therapy, which is applying constructive living techniques to working with terminally ill and chronically ill persons. As well, while he's been in town, he has facilitated a workshop for use of these techniques in treating folks with substance abuse problems. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. With us today, Greg Kretsch. We're looking at mental health from another point of view. There are principles to the process of Nikon, and also there are methods of practice, and again, in a way of giving examples for people to get a handle on. Can you look at the principles, say, with the practice of doing daily Nikon, which is a particular kind of Nikon reflection?
Well, there's three questions in Nikon that you want to ask in either in a particular relationship or, as you said, in just looking at your day. And one of those questions is, what have I received today? And the second question is, what have I given in return? And the third question is, what troubles and difficulties have I caused to others? Now, of course, the logical fourth question would seem to be, what troubles and difficulties have others caused me? And the reason that's not part of Nikon is because we're already usually really good at that. We're very good at noticing all the ways people cause us trouble.
We don't need to practice.
That we don't need to practice that more or become more skillful at it. But we usually aren't quite as skillful at noticing, for instance, how I've caused trouble to others. And so I think that's really an important question to look at. And after I began training in Nikon, I remember coming across in Benjamin Franklin's autobiography something very similar or Nikon-like in which he would identify certain qualities that he wanted to have, let's say like honesty. And then at the end of a week, he would actually sit down and make a list of all the ways that he was dishonest. So to really be evaluating ourselves against our own standards. And Nikon is really, it actually means something like self-examination or inner observation, but to really take a good look at ourselves and how we're living. And in doing that, one of the things that I find is that my list of the things that I'm receiving from people on a daily basis is always longer than the list of the things I'm giving in return. Now, when I first did that, it was somewhat of a shock to me, in part because I used to think of myself as a very giving person. And here I'm doing this Nikon, and every day I'm receiving more than I'm giving. So that really wasn't very accurate. So now I have a little bit different of an image. I think of myself more as a receiving person, or a taking person, if you prefer. But part of what I realize is much more how much I'm receiving each day. And I'm usually not giving anything anywhere near that in return. And then here's this list every day of things that I'm doing to cause people trouble. And that to me is much more practical and useful to look at because, for example, I can't control if someone lies to me. I might be very upset or angry about it or disappointed, but that's really their business. I mean, they can control that, but I can't. But I can control whether I lie to someone else. And I can't control, for instance, if someone cuts in front of me in traffic, but I can control whether I do that to someone else. And often it seems like we're so quick to be able to rationalize or justify the things we do to cause trouble, and yet we'll condemn or judge other people who are doing things to cause other people trouble. And so it seems to me that it's much more useful to take a look at, in my life, what's out of place, what am I doing that's not living up to my own standards of how I want to live, and then trying to make some changes in that area. If I keep looking at how other people are causing me trouble, it's just frustrating, because I can't do anything about how they're living their life.
Well, but here's an American question. Mm-hmm. I'm at the end of my day, and I'm lying in bed, and I'm doing my Nikon practice. What mm-hmm. have I given? What have I received? What have I done to hurt others in the course of my day, cause problems for others in the course of my day? Mm-hmm. I'm ending up with a bag of guilt. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel terrible about what I did to Harry that yesterday I could have ignored mm-hmm. because I wasn't doing Nikon. Mm-hmm.
And what a nice, healthy guilt I think that is.
Oh, this is not a bad thing.
Again, I think guilt has kind of a bad reputation in our society. And if you really think about it, for instance, if a criminal, for instance, looks at something they did, a burglary or a rape or a robbery or a murder, and they feel really, really guilty about that, doesn't that seem healthy? And aren't we more concerned about the criminal who has done that kind of thing and doesn't feel guilty? And so it may be that the magnitude of cutting someone off at traffic isn't quite as serious as a robbery. But if it's something that we've done and it's not the kind of person we want to be, not the way we want to live our life, and we feel a little bit guilty about that because we really don't want to be doing that, we'd rather let people in because that's a much nicer thing, for example, then feeling a little guilty about that seems fine to me. And feeling even a little guilty that we're receiving so much and we're not giving quite as much, to me, is a very healthy kind of guilt. In fact, I think there's a very close relationship between gratitude and guilt. We receive a lot, and if we're not giving quite as much back, we may not we may feel some debt that we owe this person in our life something because they've given us so much. So I think it's okay to feel guilty. And again, from a Morita standpoint, you feel what you feel, but then the question is, what do you need to do? Right? Do you need to change how you're driving? Do you need to not be a criminal anymore and get some kind of useful work? So the shift comes back to what do you need to actually do in your life differently?
For a beginning constructive living adherent, for someone who's just interested in starting this, mm-hmm. this is all about attention, isn't it? Looking at where I'm putting my attention?
Yeah, absolutely. And for people, for instance, let's say if there's any couples who are listening to this who are having some difficulties, or even if they're not and just want to strengthen their relationship, one of the very simple assignments, at least on the surface, is to say 10 thank yous a day to your spouse. Now, of course, if you're not getting along with your spouse, in fact, if you're really not getting along, you don't feel like saying 10 thank yous a day, but I'm not asking you to feel like it. The assignment is just say the 10 thank yous, right?
Yes.
But one of the things that happens is in order to say thank you, you have to start noticing something they're doing for you. Right, so here's this shift of attention away from how are they causing me trouble to, well, they did pick up my laundry at the cleaners the other day, or
But well, he did it under duress.
Yeah, but but see, one of the things Nikon is going to do is it really doesn't have you look at motivation.
Yes.
We really it's very hard to even know what a person's motivation is or if there's some consistent motivation, but just at what's being done. So one member, one spouse begins to look at these things and notice. Their attention shifts towards what's being done for them. And the other spouse, if they're doing 10 thank yous, is also shifting their attention. And instead of the attention just getting focused on what the person isn't doing or how they're causing trouble, you begin to shift your attention and see all the things they are doing for you. And again, it gives you a more realistic view of your relationship with them.
And whether you stay together or not, whether the relationship improves or deteriorates, you are... One is being more aware of what's really happening in it. Hmm. And that's the goal.
Yeah, I think for people, sometimes people really aren't sure whether they should stay together or split up, and that happens a lot. And I suggest to people in that situation that they really reflect on their relationship in this kind of way, whether they've been together for a month and are dating or for 20 years and are married, to really look at that relationship and look at what have I received, what have I given, and what troubles have I caused this other person, because that just gives you a realistic basis for making that decision of what you need to do. You may decide that you need to split up. But even with couples, particularly with children involved, even if you end up getting divorced, I think you'll find that it may be easier to deal with the other person, which you have to do if there's kids involved. Mm-hmm. Having done Nikon and reflected on your relationship in this way, it's very unfortunate for children when parents break up and have no ability to deal with each other, and it creates a lot of trouble, I think, for the kids.
Now, tell me about your view on the grieving side of things. If a relationship breaks up, mm-hmm. there is a grieving for the thing that is broken. If someone dies, if something is lost, some major thing is lost in mm-hmm. life, many therapies would say, I think it's kind of culturally consistent mm. to say that we assume we should give time to that grieving mm. and put our attention there mm. for a time. What does Nikon, what does Marita say about that?
Well, here's an interesting assumption that I ask people to really think about. Is it possible for someone to have a knowledge or skill that allows them to know what another person is or should be feeling? And when I've asked that, including today at the workshop we did, everyone said it's not possible. We can't really know what someone else should be or is feeling. Mm-hmm. So if someone comes in and they say, my mother just died a couple of weeks ago, and I'm really very, very, feel very, very sad and upset and I miss her, we need to accept that that's how that person feels. But what if they come in and say, my mother died a couple of weeks ago, and I don't really feel sad at all, or I don't feel any grief. In fact, I feel kind of relieved. In many cases, the response that at least some people might have is, well, you should be feeling grief. And we're really putting ourselves in the position of thinking we know what the other person should be feeling. From a constructive living standpoint, I really just need to accept whatever that person is feeling.
Yes.
If they are feeling grief, then that needs to be accepted. If they're feeling relief, that's okay too. And even the other extreme, someone who comes in and says, my mother died 20 years ago, and every time I look at her picture, I feel really, really sad and I miss her. And that needs to be accepted. And there's nothing really abnormal about any of those. So I think the reality is that that feeling grief comes from, in many ways, I think, that we loved someone and we miss them and we wish they were still around. So it's a very healthy feeling in that sense. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that I think we need to try to create or stimulate. When it's there, it's there, and we should feel it and accept it. But when it's not, that's okay too. And we shouldn't assume that it's necessary or important or something that we should be feeling, because we've created then this standard to live up to.
Right.
And each of us is a unique human being. I don't believe there is any standard that all of us need to live up to.
And from the feelers, the person who is having those feelings, point of view, those are your feelings. And Morita therapy would say there are also things to be done.
Yeah,
there's also a life to be lived.
When Jackie Onassis passed away, they wrote a lot of things about her. And one of the things that she had to do was, having gone through this incredible situation where her husband was shot in the car right next to her, days later she had to make funeral arrangements and plan things and take care of things. And I'm sure she had all kinds of feelings. But I think she got a lot of respect from that situation because of the way she handled it, because she really did what needed to be done in that situation, which not only was important for her and for her dead husband, but also for the population of the United States, who was really in shock at what had happened. So it was a good example of someone who, by doing that, not only, I think, helped themselves, but also really fulfilled an important responsibility to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I think now that she is no longer around, as we look back on her life, it's interesting that that's one of the things that gets written about her. And it brings up a very important point, which is, I think, that as we look at the reality of our mortality, that all of us, none of us are going to live forever, as far as I know, that what we leave behind, our legacy to the world, really is what we did, how we lived our life. That all those feelings we had, that time we felt really upset, the time we felt really angry, the time we felt joy, but it's really what we do in our life that impacts and touches other people. And that's the legacy that we leave behind us. And it seems to me that if you believe that's true, that we really need to have a lot of focus and attention on how we're living our life and what we're doing and what we're accomplishing. I had a student who was a few years ago who was HIV positive and died of AIDS a few summers ago. And he was a graphic artist, and he designed my stationery. And he also, during a training program, fixed and painted this little planter. And I still have that stationery, and I still have that planter. And even though he's been dead for several years, in a way, he lives on because of what he left behind. That was his legacy or gift to me as a friend and colleague of his. And so I think it's so important to really look at our legacy to the world as the things that we do and keep putting our attention into that, because that's really so important.
And the fact of the terminal illness in the case of your client, mm-hmm. did not interrupt his living fully. Mm-hmm. This is what you're telling us.
The training I did today with as a benefit for the hospice center here, which was a wonderful group of people, by the way, and it's based on the application of these principles in Japan to people with serious and terminal cancer. And I've been fortunate to work with many of those people. And one of the things they do, incredibly, is these cancer patients go mountain climbing. And they climb Mount Fuji in Japan. And a few years ago, they climbed Mount Blanc, which is the highest peak in the Alps. And these aren't young teenagers. These are people in their 40s or 50s and with cancer of the breast and ovaries and lung cancer. And they're climbing these huge mountains. And I think one of the reasons they're doing that is to demonstrate to themselves and their families and the public that even though you're ill, you can still accomplish really important and even challenging things in your life. In fact, their motto is, even though I'm ill, I won't live like a sick person, which I just think is an incredible view. And they're wonderful teachers and really courageous people. And I think they demonstrate these principles because they're living proof of them.
We've got moments left, 5 or 6. Coming up, I want to give people an opportunity to make a note if they've stayed with us and are interested in hearing more. So I'll name the tape or the book. Can you tell me where to find it? Is that good?
Sure.
Good. Okay. An audio tape called Doing a Good Job, Constructive Living at Work. It came out of the Toto Institute, of which Greg is the executive director, in 1989. Is this tape still available?
Yes, actually, we part of what we do there is we distribute all the books and tapes on constructive living. And the address, if
good.
People
so
want to,
yeah.
to write to us, we can send them, for instance, just a catalog of what's available, mm-hmm. is P.O. Box 874, Middlebury, Vermont, 05753. And I want to also mention that there's a local person here who teaches at the University of Alaska, John Waters, who is the only constructive living instructor in Alaska. And he's a really good resource. I've worked with him during my visit here, and he was in New York training last year with me. And I would really advise people to get in touch with him if they're interested in this approach to life, because I think he's a good resource on a local basis.
Good. Okay. John Waters at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Greg Kretsch at the Toto Institute, that's spelled capital T, small o, capital D, small o, Institute in Middlebury, Vermont. Let me think. Another tape, the Nikon, the tape Nikon Hidden Gifts Revealed, also a 90-minute cassette, and books, which we've mentioned before and can just briefly mention again. The most recent, edited by David Reynolds, Plunging Through the Clouds, available at the Toto Institute. Playing Ball on Running Water came out in 1984. Constructive Living, considered the grandfather of these texts, in 1984, also available at the Toto Institute. This is a lifelong practice. Are you daily practicing Morita and Nikon?
Well, the main qualification when we train people to do this is that this is the approach, or at least one of the main approaches you're using to your own life. And those are the only qualifications. You don't have to have a PhD. You don't have to have a graduate degree. So I have colleagues who are psychiatrists, and I have a colleague who's a carpenter. It really has to do with how you're living and not what education you have. And so in that sense, I'm doing the best I can at applying this to my life. But John introduced me at one of the workshops and said that I was a man who lived constructively, and I corrected him that I'm a man who has moments of living constructively, because I make lots of mistakes, and I fall flat on my face. And that one of the essays that you referred to, the one about the computer eating the paper, is called Seven Times Down, Eight Times Up.
Oh, and I meant to ask you what that is.
It's actually a kind of Japanese, comes from a Japanese saying, but it has to do with, you know, you keep falling down, but you keep getting up. Mm. And my view of constructive living is that it's not that it keeps you from falling down, because as human beings, we're going to slip and make mistakes. But it's more like you spend less time on the ground, mm-hmm. you recover faster, and over the course of a lifetime, that's a lot more time you have to do the things you want to do in your life.
Very nice. Thanks very much, Greg Kretsch.
Oh, thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to leave you with one thought. Greg mentioned that he's a man who lives... tell me again how you look
at it. Who has moments of living constructively.
Man who has moments of living constructively. I read in one of the Constructive Living quarterlies an article by a woman who said that she had been overwhelmed by shyness and... It has taken training in constructive living and now does a great deal of public speaking and mm-hmm. training, and she is now a woman who has some very shy moments in her life.
Right. And and like actually I think it would be okay for me to acknowledge who that is, because it's my wife.
Oh.
And she's also living proof of this material, because feeling shy a lot and having spent a lot of years trying to look at that and understand it and work on it without any success, she now can feel incredibly shy and goes and gives public talks in front of large groups of people. And so she really demonstrates that you can coexist with your feelings of shyness and still be able to get up in front of a group of people and give talks.
We'll leave you right there. Greg, thanks again.
Thank you, Susan.
And thank you for listening. I hope you join us again next week.